Well, good morning. Let's just get right to it. I wanted to start this morning by doing a couple little housekeeping kind of things. If you've been, let's start here. The last couple weeks, we've swam in really deep waters. I'll try not to mix metaphors here. Like, I've been told at times that you need to keep it light because, you know, congregations are pretty dumb groups of people. I think people, there was a book in seminary called They Smell Like Sheep. I've been told at various times, like, you need to be careful about telling the people the kinds of books you read, and you shouldn't talk about the things that we've kind of talked about in the last couple weeks because it'll just get people riled up. And I just want to say thank you to our church that I think we're a place that you welcome that, and you welcome good conversations and hard conversations. And it's, I was talking to somebody between services, and he said, my favorite thing that you said during the first service this morning was, I don't know. Thank you for saying I don't know. And I want to thank you all for being a place where it's safe and it's okay to say to you all, I don't know, all right? And we're going to do that, I promise. We'll do that again this morning, all right? We're going to wade into some stuff, and I'm going to tell you all in advance that I have an opinion, but I don't know. And so that's okay. And so I just want to say thank you to you all for that. I also wanted, before we get into this morning's teaching, I just wanted to take a minute. I'm just curious, and it's kind of fun, and it was interesting hearing the last service kind of talk. What are some of the things that, as we've journeyed through the life of Peter, some of the things maybe you've learned or that have stuck in your head or have been interesting or noteworthy to you as we've gone through this summer? And if you're new with us, I'm sorry. Just relax. You're getting a little summary here of what we've been doing all summer. So what stood out to you? What's been significant over the last 8, 10 weeks or whatever it's been? Okay. Moving on.
I like the fact that he's very passionate.
Yeah, the idea that Peter is really passionate really appeals to, I think, to a lot of us that, wow, he's out there and we love that about him. What else? Ariana and then Dad. That what? He's not an idiot. Yeah, sometimes Peter gets this, that's what you said, right? Sometimes Peter gets this bad rap in the church, like, oh, he's the dummy that jumped out of the boat, you know, like, and we don't find that. When you really look at Peter, he's earnest, and the reason he does some things that seem to us brash is because he's a leader type, and he's willing to take risks and lead, and that's good. Yes, what fuels him often is that desperation to be with Jesus. And so, and then that leads into the tragedy of the denial and then the beauty of the reconciliation, just that. I don't know if you've ever been at odds with somebody you care that you're at odds with, you know, and then how much that hurts, and then the reconciliation is so refreshing that, okay, we've got that, we're past that. Yeah, that's good. Anything else? Yeah. Yeah, pretty transparent. We don't know much about the other disciples, but we know a lot about Peter. And so it's interesting to see his life transform. It's interesting to see where it goes, and we're going to finish that out this morning. Anybody else? So the question that has been in my head as we've worked through this whole series is how do you go from being a regular, everyday fisherman to getting a church named after you someday, all right? Not that we're aspiring to that. I don't know if any of us, when we were little, thought, maybe when I grow up, the head of the church in the world will be named after me. If so, I would say, temper your aspirations a little bit, all right? If any of my sons come to me and say, when I grow up, I want to have a basilica named after me, I'm going to say, one, you're a pastor kid nerd, and two, let's shoot for accountant. But how do you go from the life of an everyday fisherman, just that's as a symbol, to being the person that Peter was? How does that happen? And so this morning what we're going to do is we're going to reflect on that. We're going to go back and do an overview of his life, and then we're going to lead into his death, and then finally talk about some of the ways that we see Peter today. So I want to do this for just a minute, all right? Now, this is the point in the movie where we do the slow motion and we play the title song that's going to be on the radio, and you're always going to remember. You know what I'm talking about? That point where we do the flashback, we're going to do the flashback, all right? All this is going to happen in slow motion with Peter's hair flowing in the breeze, all right? And we're going to cut into moments of dialogue. So it starts that he's a fisherman from Bethsaida, right? And he's out on the shores and he's muscular and throwing the nets, right? And so that's how we met Peter at first. And then he was called by Jesus, and in that dramatic moment in the film, he drops his nets and he Baywatched himself across the beach to Jesus, right? All right, so you're tracking with me. This is what we're doing right now, all right? And so then the next big episode we see in the life of Peter is probably the walk on water, which I didn't put on here, which you would have to have in the montage. But the next big moment is the Matthew 16 moment, where Jesus says to his first followers, who do you say that I am? And they say, well, everybody says this about you, and they say this, and they say this thing, and they say this thing. And he says, I know what everybody else says, but you, what do you think of me? And it's Peter, as a leader of the disciples, that says, well, you're the Christ. You're the Messiah. You're the one we've been waiting for. You're the Son of the living God. And Jesus says, upon this rock I will build my church. And we're going to turn to that passage in a couple minutes and kind of unpack that again. But that's a big moment. And then the next really big moment is we get is the denial, where it says, with an oath, he said he never knew him. That's the best oath I could come up with. I didn't know if there was a standard formulation for comic swearing. I just hit some buttons, all right? And that's what I came up with. So don't try to figure out what I was really trying to say there, because it's nothing, all right? I didn't do like dollar sign, something. Anyway, and so then the next big episode in Peter's life, you see this progression of these big moments. The next big moment then is the reconciliation with Jesus out of John 21, where Jesus says to Peter, Simon, do you love me? And Peter responds with, of course I love you. And Jesus says what to him? This is important for later in the sermon. Jesus says what to him? Feed my sheep. And then he says to him again, Simon, do you love me? And Peter says, of course I love you. And Jesus says, take care of my sheep. And then the third time he comes back and says, feed my sheep again. Three times Peter's told, feed my sheep. And we're going to come back to that in just a little while. So then the next scene in the montage would be probably Peter having a vision, which is a really boring part of our montage because it just looks like him having his eyes shut. But maybe we'd see the vision with the sheep descending with all the yummy pork products descending out of the sky. And Peter says, no, I've never eaten pork in my life. And God says to him, do not call impure what God has made clean. And so then maybe we'd see Peter going off to Joppa to visit Cornelius and joining in their dinner, going into their house, which would not have been okay for him as a Jew. And then finally, we got the episode from last week in Acts 15, where Peter stands up at the Jerusalem Council and talks about the acceptance of the Gentiles and says, basically, we thought that when Messiah came, it would just be a Jewish thing. And what we've come to understand is it's not a Jewish thing. It's for everybody. And at that point there, Peter steps off the pages. And I think I said this last week. Peter steps off the pages of our scriptures. We don't hear from Peter again. That's it. And so the question arises, and we just want to wrap this up real quick, is what happened to Peter after Acts 15? Where does Peter go? Well, let me back up for a minute. This is, in case you were sleeping during sixth grade social studies, this is the Roman Empire at its height. It's in the red. And so we're going to zoom in now to that area. So that's Jerusalem, roughly. That's about where Jerusalem would have been. Now, Peter was from Bethsaida, which would have been in the north part on the north side of the Sea of Galilee. After Jesus leaves, the early church is centered in Jerusalem, and Peter is at the center of that church. But we see in the Cornelius story that Peter went to where? Anybody remember? There was a town that he went to. Bible trivia. Anyone? Right, if you were thinking Joppa. Yes, Joppa is the answer. And Joppa today, does anybody know where Joppa is today? Besides the smart aleck in the first service said it's in the lower red dot. Besides that, does anybody know where Joppa is today? It's what? It's been consumed in Tel Aviv. So it's basically now like a neighborhood of Tel Aviv. All right, it's just kind of been, that's where it's at. It's on the coast, port city. So Peter, we see in Acts 10, by responding to the call of Cornelius, Peter steps out of the Jerusalem church, goes down to Joppa. We assume he went back. But then in Acts 15, we find out that Peter's been somewhere else. Anybody remember that location? Again, you were thinking Antioch. You are dead on, all right? So we find Peter in Antioch, which is now quite a ways away. And what we find in Acts 10 is a pretty strong hint that Peter had walked away from his position of authority in the Jerusalem church, and that the Jerusalem church now is being led by James, the brother of Jesus. And so Peter's off in Antioch. And then if we zoom this picture out and pick up the story, we find in church tradition, that's what we know from the Bible, from church tradition, it's believed that Peter continued to journey and found himself in Corinth for at least 7 years. There's evidence from church history, there's evidence in the early writings that there was a group of Peters in Corinth. And some people believe that Peter may have left his family in Corinth as he journeyed on to Rome, but that his family might have continued to live in Corinth. And actually, if you really dig into the church history documents, you can find that there's people who claim, and I believe still today, to be direct descendants of Peter. Because that would be convenient. Like, we need a new pastor. Yeah, let me look at my application. You ought to check out about the fifth line. I'm descendant of Peter. Got the job. So there's still people that claim that today. I just said, then Peter, oops, I went backwards. He did not go backwards. Then Peter pushed on to Rome. And actually, we know that from scriptures too, because when we study 1 and 2 Peter, we're going to find that, I think it's in 1 Peter when he's wrapping up the letter, he says, he sends greetings from Babylon, and we're pretty confident that at that point, Peter's using Babylon as code word for Rome. And so we're pretty confident that Peter spent his last days in Rome. And then there's some discussion, and I'll get to it in just a minute, about what he was doing in Rome while he was there, okay? To how Peter died. About 65 AD, roughly, there was persecutions across the empire. There was a fire in Rome. Many people believe that Nero actually set the fire himself, I believe is how the story goes, as an excuse to go kill the Christians. So he could set a fire and then go back and blame the Christians for it and persecute them. It's believed that Peter may have been one of the casualties of some of these first waves of persecution in Rome against the Christians. And so Peter was crucified around 64, 65 AD is what they believe. According to church tradition, though, does anybody know how Peter was crucified? Upside down. So in church tradition, if you see an upside down cross, that's the cross of St. Peter. It's an homage to him and his martyrdom. That Peter, it appears, church tradition tells us that Peter didn't find himself worthy to be crucified in the same way as Jesus. So he requested to be crucified upside down. That's a painting of that event. Origen, one of the early church fathers, tells us that Peter was crucified at Rome with his head downwards as he himself had desired to suffer. I want to pause right here for just a minute. And just to get your mind thinking. I grew up in Cold War era, all right? I'm old enough that Red Dawn wasn't just a cool movie. It was a possibility that the Russians were going to drop in my playground yard any day and I might have to flee to the mountains and defend our country, right? Like, that's the world. Some of you are young enough that you don't remember how serious this was. Like, there was a movie when I was a kid. I think I was in about fourth grade. There was a movie came out called The Day After. Does anybody remember this? Like, yes. Everybody my age-ish and older, we remember this. Like, it was scary. Like, the idea that if we get into a nuclear war with Russia, this is what it might look like afterwards. And I remember, like, all these warnings. Like, parents, be careful if you're going to let your kids watch this because it's scary stuff, all right? Some of you, eyes glassed over, you don't, big deal, all right? Just acknowledge me, big deal. And I remember growing up, at least in the traditions I was part of, and I don't know if this was in other church traditions, but at least in the tradition I grew up on, it was a big deal talking about martyrdom. Like, and I remember this scenario playing out probably in a chapel service somewhere in high school or something about if you were in communist Russia and if somebody put a gun to your head, what would you say? And the right answer in those contexts is like, I would stand up to him. I would totally stand up. And yet there was always this nagging sense in me that I wasn't so sure. Like, I want to believe that I would do the right thing. I want to believe that I would be faithful to the point of death. But man, that's big, right? Like, if we're really honest with ourselves and somebody puts a gun to our head, that's a scary moment for all of us. And so when I think about the first followers of Jesus, especially in the context of the Roman persecutions, and you think about somebody like Peter, it's pretty remarkable. And I have so much admiration and respect. And I probably should have used this picture on the first slide. How do you go from being an ordinary fisherman on the banks of the Sea of Galilee to being the kind of person who will say, yeah, if this is the price that it takes, if this is what it costs me, fair enough, that's what it costs. And I think there's a lot to learn and a lot to admire in Peter from that. The question I want to kind of spend a little bit, a couple minutes here with then, though, this morning, is this one. What have we done with Peter today? I said when we started this series, if you were around back in June, I said when we started that in my upbringing, in my very, very Protestant Reformed upbringing, we didn't talk about Peter very much. We talked a lot about Paul and sometimes about Jesus, but we didn't talk about Peter a lot, very much. And I think that part of that is a Protestant backlash. You know, like the Catholics, we know what the Catholics think about Peter, and so we're not giving them anything, all right? So we're going to make sure we keep Peter kind of like what we do with Mary, right? Like they like Mary way too much, so we're going to under-like her to balance out the cosmic scales, all right? And if you don't know, we sang the Hail Mary this morning, just snuck that in for you. So I grew up in a tradition where we didn't talk about Peter a lot. And so what I want to do this morning is just for a couple minutes. And for some of you, this will be really interesting and really fascinating. For some of you, you're not going to get why I'm making such a big deal, except to tell you up front, this is a really big deal to some folks. All right? And the question is what we've done with Peter in the later traditions. So we're going to start with this one, and we're going to talk about the Catholic tradition. So in the Catholic tradition, what do they believe about Peter? It's on the screen. You can't get this wrong, all right? That he was the first pope. That basically the Catholic understanding is that Peter was the first pope, and if you take Pope Francis and you track all the way backwards to Pope Benedict, then to Pope John Paul II, then to Pope whoever was before him, that's before my lifetime, you just keep going back, you can trace an unbroken line all the way back to St. Peter, that popes come from Peter, they have authority, and that we should listen to them because they descend, not genetically, but the chain is unbroken all the way back to Peter. And there's a couple reasons why they believe this. I want you to turn your Bibles to page 797, or Matthew chapter 16, if you're using a digital device or you brought your own Bible. We're going to read this passage because it's a really important one and it comes into play in this discussion. And then we're going to look at some of the reasons that I've already put up on the screen for you about why Catholics believe that Peter was the first pope. And then we're going to talk about why Protestants believe otherwise. Then we're going to talk about maybe a middle position. And then we're going to close this out. All right? Matthew chapter 16. Let's just read this together. Starting in verse 13, down at the bottom of the page on 797. When Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say the Son of Man is?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others, Jeremiah, or one of the prophets." "But what about you?" he asked. "Who do you say I am?" Simon Peter answered, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God." Jesus replied, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not revealed to you by flesh and blood, but by my Father in heaven. And I tell you that you are Peter, you are Petros," is his Greek name. "And on this Petra," the Greek word for little rock, "I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overcome it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven." Then he ordered his disciples not to tell anyone he was the Messiah. So this this passage of scripture becomes very important in this discussion about how we understand Peter Day and what we think of Peter Day. This is the big one, and there's others that I'll allude to and point to, but this is the real biggie in this discussion, all right? And as you see it, what does this all hinge on? It hinges on one word. When Jesus says, "Upon this rock I will build my church," to whom or what is Jesus referring? What are the options? Real quick, give me the two options. I hear a mumbling. Somebody just say it real clear. Peter is one option, that he's referring specifically to Peter. "You are the rock upon which the whole church will be built." So therefore, for time immemorial, when somebody tells a joke about heaven, you get to stand at the gates, all right? Right? All right. What's the other option? What's Peter doing here? What does this rock refer to? Anybody? You're all Protestants. This should have been the first one you said. Yeah, that statement that Peter makes, that you are the Christ, the Son of the living God, that statement is what Jesus is referring to. That statement of Jesus' messiahship, that is the cornerstone upon which the church will be built. All right? You see how this is forming up now? Which side thinks it's Peter? Catholics, and which side thinks it's the statement? Okay, good. We're all here. We're all awake. All right. So real quickly, so when Catholics say that they believe Peter was the first pope, they're saying that they believe in this statement that upon this rock I'll build my church, it's Peter. That Jesus is building the church on Peter, and that Peter is the one that has the authority, all these things here, to bind, to loose, the keys of the kingdom, that all this is authority language, and that Peter, therefore, is in the role as the first pope, and that goes on down. And they also say, the second piece of Catholic theology here, is to say that in John 21, where Peter is told by Jesus, feed my sheep, serve my sheep, feed my sheep, that Jesus has in mind that Peter will act as pastor to all of the followers of Jesus. Time forever and ever, all right? Oh, that's awesome. Do you understand what they're saying there? Do you understand? Does that make sense to you? Do you see why they say what they say there? And then the third piece of their understanding of why Peter was the first pope is that according to church tradition, especially in the Catholic tradition, they believe that when Peter arrived in Rome, after leaving Corinth and settling in Rome, that Peter then was the first bishop of Rome. He was the head of the church of Rome, setting up the Roman pontiff and all those things, right? Understand that? So what they believe then is that when he does that and then he dies, he passes it on to the next person. So if you studied church history, here's what you find out. I'll give you a really crash course in the early church. In the early church, what city is the head of the church? Jerusalem. Good. All right. In 70 AD, what happens to Jerusalem? It's destroyed, all right? So in the mix of all that, prior to the destruction of Jerusalem, you have this popping up, and eventually you have four centers of Christianity. Anyone want to take a stab at the four? Just mumble something at me, and then I'll say it clearly. Constantinople, Antioch, Rome, and Alexandria. Well done. First service would never be able to pull that off. Actually, I couldn't think of Antioch earlier. Or which one died? No, I left off Constantinople and couldn't think of it for service. Anyway, and so Peter becomes the head of the Roman church, one of the significant centers of Christianity. And then eventually, when we get to much later in church history, when it splits, Rome is the center of Christianity. We still see that echoing out today. I just want to say this. Do you see how Catholics arrive at this place where they say, well, Peter was the first pope. This is how Jesus set it up. Do you see this? Because I grew up, again, in a tradition that wasn't always good at presenting the other side, and so that we believed Catholics were at best crazy and at worst heretics and said things like, well, they just go around worshiping a pope, which is not fair. Nobody's worshiping a pope. They just believe that going back to Peter, this is what Jesus intended, that there would be an earthly representative who would feed the sheep, care for the sheep, who would bind and loose and hold the keys to the kingdom of heaven. And it goes back to this moment. They believe that it goes all the way there, and that's where they get it. All right? Does it make sense? Even if you don't agree, do you understand? All right? That's all we're after. I like the head nodding. That's nice. Thank you for affirming me in that. All right? Well, go through history, and then we get to the Protestant Reformation. And one of the things that happened in the Protestant Reformation is there's lots of good in the Protestant Reformation. We're obviously, most of us in here, I think, come from Protestant backgrounds. We believe in the Protestant Reformation. But some of the excesses of the Protestant Reformation, and we've talked about this in other areas, is, well, if the Catholics believe it, we don't. We don't know why yet. We're just sure that we don't believe it, all right? And so then we're going to go to the other extreme. So they, like I said earlier, they all really like Mary. We're going to go to an extreme to make sure that we don't ever discuss Mary again. And so like I said, I've told you all before, I think I say this every Advent, I grew up in churches where I don't remember ever working through the Magnificat. One of my favorite prayers in all of Scripture these days, we didn't talk about it much because, you know, it's Mary's prayer, you know, and the Catholics really like this one, and so therefore, let's talk about wise men, all right? So that's sometimes what happens. And so some of the theology of the Protestant Reformation, like any movement in history, is driven by historical context. Like whatever the Catholics believe, let's push off against that. All right. So understand that that's what drives some of this, and we'll come to mediation. But Protestants come along and they say, listen, when we look at that passage and we look at the Greek verbs and the Aramaic and the Greek and all that stuff, what we believe is that Peter was just a disciple like all of us. And they say in that passage, we believe that the statement, upon this rock I will build my church, is about what we talked about earlier. It's about the statement that Jesus is the cornerstone. And Protestants point to other places in Scripture, and they go to Peter's own writings, which we're going to get to later in the fall, where Peter himself says things like, it's a priesthood of all believers. All believers are priests. There is no hierarchy. And they would go to places like Hebrews and say, listen, we don't need a high priest anymore. We don't need a pope sitting in Rome anymore. That's the whole point. And so they would say that Jesus didn't intend any of this. And they might even point to places in the scriptures, like we looked at last week in Acts 15, where Peter himself said, you know what, I know I'm the leader of the church of Jerusalem, but forget that. I'm going off to Antioch, and then I'm going to go to Corinth, and then I'm going to go to Rome. I don't need to be the head leader in the main place anymore. I can go on and do other works. And so they'd point at some of those things. And then they would say, and when we look at our historians, we don't see that Peter was the bishop. Yeah, Peter was in Rome, but we don't see anywhere that says. And so, you know, it's like these things. Have you ever been in an argument with somebody and they say, well, I read somewhere that it says this. And somebody says, well, I read somewhere it says this. I got my thing. Your guy's an idiot. No, your guy's an idiot. You've been in these moments, right? And so that's what happens in this discussion is we all line up our verses, we line up our things. Some people have come back and tried to do some kind of a mediating position, which is probably the one I probably like the best, is this one. I'll call it Protestant A. Is that Peter was the leader of the early church. This passage was about Peter, but there wasn't intended to be any succession of that. And what these folks say that I really like is that when Scripture says, upon this rock I will build my church, is it talking about Peter or the statement? Yep, all of it. That when Jesus says, upon this rock, he is acknowledging Peter. And we see Peter in the early church doing huge things. I think it's easy for us to look at the stories from the last couple weeks, Acts 10, Acts 15, and go, yeah, that's fine. And to miss how significant these things are. For Peter to say, I had a vision this afternoon, and now I've decided that I don't have to be kosher anymore. I don't even know how to help you all understand how big this is. I don't know how to even convey what a big move Peter feels like he has the authority to make. And I think Peter thinks that he has this authority because going back to Matthew 16, Jesus told him he had that authority. And we always say that Paul is the apostle to the Gentiles, but it's Peter who hands him the baton and says, go. I'm with this. This is what God is doing. The Holy Spirit is coming to the Gentiles. We need to go in these areas. And so Peter really is acting in his lifetime in a way that seems to suggest Peter really believed that he had the authority and the permission to shape Christianity in the early years. And so this position says that we need to take that really seriously, that Peter did take on a role and people did look to Peter to take on that role. But they also say then but that was not intended to be a role that was forever and ever and passed down to whoever, whatever the rules are for passing it down to the next pope and go into a room and vote and the colored smoke comes up. It was not, that was not the intention. Jesus did not have in mind all that. Let me just say a couple things, because I know some of you are already bored by this discussion. I apologize. But I just want to say, this is a really, really huge issue. If you grew up Catholic or are still Catholic, this is a really big issue. We had some folks in the first service who are Catholics, and they acknowledge, man, this is a really big deal. Most other things in terms of Protestant Catholic theology, we can work around. We really can. And in fact, there's been real serious attempts among some Protestants and Catholics to come to joint statements. For example, justification by faith. Do you know that there are places where Protestants and Catholics have worked together and are basically in agreement? Yeah, we can figure out a way to make all this work. And there's a lot of places where Catholics and Protestants can worship and work together in the world. But this one, the infallibility and stuff of the Pope and, you know, the primacy of the Pope, that shades a lot of other things. And it's one of those areas where you either believe this thing or you don't. And it's really hard to do it both ways. And so for many people, this issue is a really, really big, big, important issue. I would say that there's probably two issues in Catholicism, this one and then the idea of transubstantiation. And those two things, I was talking to somebody at first service, like I was amazed as I've gotten older that us being Protestants and Catholics, we agree on almost everything. And there's like these two things that steamed in our way of being fully united. And they're right. This is a really big issue, even if it's not in your world. And I just want to tell you, when you start getting into this, there was this moment of studying this weekend, Friday was my study day this week. So it was Friday, I was studying it. And I got to this point where I literally like took off my glasses and put my head in my hands. It's like, I don't even understand what I'm reading anymore. Because it was about, yeah, this is written in Greek and in Greek, blah, 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 blah. But wait a minute, Jesus would have said this in Aramaic. So we have to understand the Aramaic and understand how the Aramaic got translated to Greek, got translated to English, so we can understand that this noun is a male noun, and this is a female verb, and I'm completely lost, right? I got about this deep, I got about waist deep in this whole thing, and then I thought of sharks and I ran out of the water. It gets really hairy, all right? It gets really, this issue, because it's such an important issue, lots of scholars have spent a lot of time. And for some of you, maybe I've whetted your appetite, and somebody came up to me after first service, like, tell me where to go. I want to read more about this. I'm like, more power to you. Because it's a really technical discussion. All this we're just trying to say is this. Yeah. Yeah, I'll take a time out and answer that. This happens throughout. Jesus heals people and don't tell anybody. And we assumed that was a temporary situation. He wanted them to tell later. But as far as what was happening right then and there, it was, hey, this is between us. And so this conversation is a very intimate conversation about what do you guys, either his 12 or maybe there was some of the women involved there too, that what do you all think about me? And okay. But let's keep this on the down low because it's not time yet to kind of go full bore with this. So, yeah. I want to end this part, and then we'll wrap up for the morning. Is just to say, it's a huge issue with a lot of technicalities. And I think that one of the things I love in our church is that when we scratch the surface and get beyond the straw men and saying silly things like the Catholics worship Mary or worship the Pope and really dig into the text, we find that it's much more complicated and difficult than that. And I'm giving you permission to respect people that we don't agree with. And you may be Protestant through and through. You might have Protestant tattoos on you, like Protestant to the core. That's fine. That's fine. That's weird, but it's fine. But we can have respect for our brothers and sisters who look at this passage and love Jesus and love God every much as we do and just see it differently. And I told you there were some Catholics here the earlier service, and one of the girls talked to me, and we're going to get together and have coffee when I get back from vacation here in the next couple weeks, and just talk about how do Catholics and Protestants love each other more, and how do we serve together, and how do we be brothers and sisters, even if we both look at the same text and go, I see it my way, and I don't see it that way, I see it this way, and especially when we understand that it's there's a lot of technical arguments and arguments from history to say that, hey, it's okay to disagree. Fair enough? So, I'll say the words. I don't know. All right? I have an opinion. I kind of go with the Protestant A option. But we may get in heaven and find out that we were supposed to be paying attention to the Pope all along. All right? Maybe not. If St. Peter will let us in. At all. All right. You didn't accept my popes. You're out. Here's where I want to end. Here's where I want to end the life of Peter. How do you go from being a fisherman to somebody that we respect and we revere so much? How does a person just go from minding his own business, doing the family trade with one's brothers and close friends, the sons of Zebedee, how do you go from there and get to a spot where he's so revered? And especially in our Protestant traditions, not revered enough, but should be more. We should look to Peter as he was the man. He was the guy in the early church who led the church. First generation, he took us from the point of Jesus to handing the baton off to the Gentiles and saying, hey, this is for everybody. And that's big. It was Peter. How does that happen? Tomorrow morning, I'll be getting up and getting in our van with 240,000 miles on it and driving the family to Colorado and praying the whole way that the van comes back. It'd be beautiful if the van comes back and dies in the driveway, that'd be awesome. There's signs of death coming for the dear van. The locks are intermittent. Some windows don't roll down. The radio doesn't turn itself off sometimes. So we're going to be driving. All I'd say, we're going to be heading west. And so I was thinking about the life of Peter and directions and thinking about if you were going to fly to Denver from Peoria, Illinois, it's almost a straight shot. You set your headings on west and you just go. And if you fell asleep for several hours, you'd miss nothing. It's called Nebraska. There's just nothing, all right? I know you love Nebraska. You get to Denver. And yet somehow, it seems so little, but if you just take your plane that's supposed to be going west and you aim it like this much, you can miss Denver by hundreds of miles, right? That spread out over a lifetime, little choices that you make now and little things you do right now set in place trajectories that can last a lifetime. I think that what's beautiful about the life of Peter, one of the many things that's beautiful about the life of Peter, is Peter just kept saying yes to Jesus. He kept adjusting his trajectory, and when Jesus says, "Follow me here, Peter," Peter moved the trajectory. And so that when the next thing came along, he said yes to Jesus again. When Jesus invited him again, "Here, follow me in this way, Peter. Follow me out of the boat. Follow me into this. Follow me into my love for the Gentiles. Peter, follow me to death." That because this man chose to drop his nets, and then chose to get out of the boat, and then chose to respond, and then chose, and then chose, and then chose, and kept on making choices to follow Jesus and set himself up in a trajectory, he was ready for the next yes. And I think that no matter where we are in the spiritual journey, it doesn't matter whether we've been following Jesus for a short time or a long time, to me, questions of trajectory are always really, really powerful in my life. Because I can just start making lists. Like, what's the trajectory of my marriage? Are we growing in a way? Are we getting better? Are we growing closer, more intimate? Or is the trajectory of our marriage off here somewhere? And it may not matter today if we gave each other the silent treatment, but extend that over the next 30 years and you've got problems. Or am I following Jesus with my money? Oh yeah, today it might not make a difference if you really just say, "Oh, I know somebody else needs this, but I'll just spend it on me. I need to spend more money on me today." That's one thing. But when you start compounding those decisions over a lifetime, it's a pretty significant. Or just this one little moral thing. Like, I know that I shouldn't be doing this thing here, but this a little bit can't hurt. And yet somehow that trajectory just takes us on a different pathway. And when I see the life of Peter and I think about what it looks like to move from being a fisherman to being somebody who's willing to die, to pay the ultimate price to follow Jesus, I think it's about trajectory. It's about keeping on choosing to follow Jesus. And so I'm going to pray and I'm going to leave us just with one little question as we end the life of St. Peter, is what's the trajectory of my life? What's the trajectory of your life? Where are you headed right now? And you can fill in an area, you know, like, I told the first service, this morning I was in the kitchen hanging out with the team for a couple minutes, just saying hi this morning and drinking coffee, and they were cleaning up the breakfast, and somebody offered me 4 sausages, because there was 4 left in the pan. And 2-3 years ago, for sure, 4 sausages, I'm just serving the church. And I would have woofed those down like Peter after the vision of the net, you know, like it just happened. But a couple years ago, I changed my trajectory about food and diet and how I live my life, and you guys have all seen that. And this morning, I said no, and I didn't even think about it, because that's just not the way I roll anymore, you know? Not that I'm against sausage. I love sausage in moderation and at particular times, and just because there's 4 of them there doesn't mean I need to put them in my mouth. My thing, right? But I changed a trajectory in my life. And I made some decisions that led to this and that set a different pathway in my life than the one I was on. I had a friend several years ago, and it was when I was in the process of that and some other things and some other disciplines in my life, and I was like, it just doesn't feel like I'm making big enough changes, because I tend to think that I have to make these drastic life-altering, like, all right, tomorrow's the day where I make this big life-changing event. And he's like, and he got up on my board, and I wish I had my whiteboard in here, and he drew a line. And he said, but if you just change this little thing and you extend that out over your life, look how much it changes over time. And it was an encouragement to me that the littlest things sometimes matter. The littlest changes we make in how we follow Jesus, how I handle my finances, how I treat my wife, how I treat my kids, the ethical choices I make, those little things that seem such small steps in following Jesus, when you take those over a lifetime, are huge. So where is Jesus asking you to change your trajectory? Let's pray.